Hello, and welcome to the Yet Another Value Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Walker. And with me today, I'm excited to have my friend, Zach Silver. Zach is an analyst over at, I call it FBR all the time, but it's B. Riley now. He covers kind of the TMT space for B. Riley, including one of my favorite sectors, a lot of the Liberty companies. So, Zach, how's it going?
It's great. Thanks for having me on, Andrew. Appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you being on, and let me start the podcast the way I do every podcast, and that's by pitching you, my guest. In general, I kind of avoid sell-side research. I find most of it is kind of, if you want to know the consensus and if you want to invest with the consensus, you go to sell-side. So it really focuses on kind of the trees and misses the forest, you know, what's next quarter's EPS number versus is this growing value? So I avoid most of it. I can count on one handful the number of sell-side analysts I talk to, respect, listen to, and you're one of those analysts. So it's great to have you on the pod. I love reading everything you put out and appreciate you being on here. So that pitch out the way, you know, why don't you give us just a quick background of you, B. Riley, and what you cover?
Yeah, that sounds great. First-time caller, long-time listener, big fan of the podcast. And For B. Riley in general, I think that, standard kind of run-of-the-mill investment bank focused on small and mid-cap equities. We actually own one of the top three appraisal and liquidation companies for retail, yep. Mostly, you know, asset-heavy, inventory-heavy companies, and pretty diversified platform there. It's pretty interesting. The sector that I cover, again, you have TMT, focus a lot on the Liberty names, focus on kind of the old school broadcasters, radio and TV stations, and also sort of have exhausted the entire universe of small and mid-cap cable and wireless, which there are not many. But enjoy thinking about, the future of cable and in the sort of small mid-cap context.
Perfect. So let's just start with your coverage universe. You know, it's pretty eclectic. We mentioned a couple of the Liberty guys, you know, Formula One, Gliba, SiriusXM, super small cable companies, legacy radio. There's some broadcasters in there. And now you've got a startup streamer, CuriosityStream, which I think we're going to be talking about at the end of the podcast. So all of it's kind of loosely media. Is that really what connects it all, just loose media? Or is there anything other kind of connecting force behind what you cover and what you look to cover?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, one kind of thread that runs through a lot of the coverage is just the John Malone Liberty Complex. And that's, you know, born out of when I came to, B. Riley now, the analyst that I joined under guy Barton Crockett was sort of a longtime sell-side analyst covering the Liberty names and inherited a lot of those and sort of looked for tangential opportunities in the sectors that they focus on. And, that's where cable and wireless came from. That's where some of the legacy media came from. And, generally focusing on media and cable and wireless.
Perfect. And you're unique to this podcast. You're the first sell side person we've had on. So I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which our listeners might be interested in, like when you deal, obviously as a sell side, your job is kind of connect buy side and companies, put out research reports that buy side finds interesting, you know, buy, sell, all that type of stuff. But what do you find really separates kind of the best buy side people who you interact with kind of your run of the mill people that you cover and who you use? You like, what are the questions or the way they interact with you that separates them?
That's a really interesting question. I think that I would first say that all of the buy siders that I interact with are, you know, incredibly smart and know everything, you know, super well. And
I love all my children.
Yeah, exactly. I would say that, ones that are really focusing on industries that are in flux and change and how things may look, you know, years from now versus, you know, again, this, you know, coming quarter are the ones that, you know, I think lead to the most fruitful conversations. Looking at sectors and companies from different angles, kind of bucking the consensus, being a, you know, somewhat of a contrarian, if you will, is often leads to the best conversations. I think that, you know, everyone, you know, on in your side of the world is so smart that, you know, there's very little that, you know, that have some intro conversations on, you know, kind of folks that are newer to the stories. But by and large, I mean, most folks that I speak with know their stuff. So the ones that can really approach things from, you know, a totally different angle and will actually, for me, you know, they'll bring something up that I've never even thought of. I mean, those are the most valuable conversations that I have with the buy side.
Okay. No, that's great. So, and do you find like the ones who are bringing stuff up that you've never thought of or something, are they coming to you and are they saying, are they bouncing an idea off you? So, you know, over the summer, I kind of thought a company might be hitting an inflection point. Do I bounce it off you or am I coming with a fully kind of baked to you? Hey, I think this inflection point's happening. Am I wrong here? Am I missing something? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a mix of both. I mean, there will be some that will quickly point out something that I've missed. And sometimes, you know, it's something that I just disagree with them on, you know, something that's not black and white. And, you know, sometimes it could be, oh, I've never really thought of that way. You know, it's a good way to look at it. Other times it will be folks that, you know, are deep in a position and they, you know, you know, maybe I have a less bullish or less bearish view on something and they want me to sort of reconsider my thinking on that. You know, oftentimes the things that I've researched are pretty well researched and I won't, but you know, a lot of times they'll bring up new ideas that I haven't thought of. And you know, a lot of times it's just they're fleshing out an idea, you know, about a sector or about a trend or about a specific company, where, you know, they'll use me as a resource, particularly if they're newer to the story, to sort of help kind of crystallize their thoughts and kind of get the other side of the table, if you will.
Perfect. Perfect. And now we're going to spend most of the podcast talking about First Liberty Day, which happened last week, and then Curiosity Stream. But just before we dive into those, you know, obviously you cover 15 to 20 stocks or so. What's the most interesting name in your coverage universe right now, do you think?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that there, you know, are a couple that jump out at me. I would say that in terms of a company that's really in a state of flux and there may be some opportunity. And again, you know, because I am on the sell side, I have to stay consistent with, you know, my opinion. But I would say that one that is interesting, you know, for better or for worse, is one that I know that you're familiar with, Shentel.
Yeah.
Which the background on them is they were a Sprint affiliate and controlled sort of the Virginia and West Virginia territories. And basically when the T-Mobile merger went through, Timo decided to reclaim the subscribers in Shentel's markets. And what will happen is that Shentel has also got a fairly substantial broadband business that they've been focused on expanding throughout this rural territory where there's not a whole lot of competition. And it's very difficult to justify sort of an overbuilder in those markets, almost like a Cable One type story. And what will happen with Shentel is they'll have this very large infusion of cash when they sell the wireless business to Timo. And it'll be interesting to see what they do with that broadband business because, you know, in those rural markets, I think that if they're able to execute right, I mean, they've got a pretty long runway for growth.
No, it's funny you mentioned Shentel because I agree it's really interesting. And especially, I think you initiated coverage on it maybe 2 years ago or so, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, I think it was September 18th.
Yeah. And I remember when you initiated, I had been looking at it separately and you and I went back and forth on it a lot because there were a lot of moving parts and stuff. And actually last week I judged a stock pitching competition for Warden's undergrad. I can't remember if it's went undergrad or grad school, but I judged a stock pitching competition and someone pinned Shentel as a short.
And
I was like, they did a very nice job covering the thing, but I was like, this is a really interesting situation. I was trying to refresh on all the stuff you and I talked about over the years. So that's the most interesting name. What about, you know, I think you've got buys on about 10 to 12 of the companies you follow. If somebody called you up and was like, hey, you know, of the companies you buy, what is the most undervalued company right now? Not the most interesting, but most undervalued. What stock would you be pointing them to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've, you know, talked about Wide Open West, about WOW. And, you know,
that's the one I was looking for, Zach, right there.
I think that when you look at that, you just look at the valuations for broadband providers. You know, there's I think the leverage is hairy in the ownership, the low liquidity, but you look at some of the valuations that these broadband assets have gotten recently in the market, and you look at WOW sitting there, I think probably at around 6.5 times next year's EBITDA, somewhere, you know, EBITDA less CapEx at, you know, kind of low teens range. And it's just on a private market basis, it is wildly more valuable than what the market gives it credit for today. And I would say that that's probably, you know, glaringly undervalued, you know, just based on this argument about private market value.
Look, I think, especially when you start talking, you know, your coverage, you've got the legacy radio companies, you've got some of the broadcasters and stuff. We're not going to talk about those, but there's a lot of stuff where I think you look at the private market value and it's probably these trade too cheaply. But a lot of those do have what I would say terminal value questions. And with WOW, yeah. The thing I like about that is, first, we'll start with the disclosure. Nothing on here is investing advice. WOW is a small cap with a lot of leverage, and it's kind of the stock's a little bit on the illiquid side. But when you look at that, I think management's gotten disciplined. They're not going to be overbuilding as much. They're really going to focus on kind of increasing penetration, juicing that cash flow and paying down debt. You look at the multiples, you know, I'm biased here. You know, I've got a position in the stock and I love it, but I think it's really interesting as well. But let's turn to some other interesting companies. We were going to do this podcast last week. We pushed it to this week because we realized, hey, Liberty Investor Day, Zach covers three of the companies. I love Liberty. Everybody who follows me knows that. Why don't we do it this week and we can talk Liberty Investor Day? So Liberty Investor Day was last week. You cover three of the Liberty companies, Gliba, which is their, it's really their position in Charter, but it's also an Alaskan cable company. You cover SiriusXM, which Liberty basically controls through Liberty Sirius, and you cover Formula One. So let's talk Liberty Investor Day. Any big takeaways, surprises, either in the companies you cover or the companies you don't cover for them?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a little interesting being all virtual this year. And I thought that, you know, the opening dialogue that Maffei gave, I mean, it was interesting how they touched on a lot more industries and a lot more broad themes than usual. Obviously, the most interesting thing that came out of that was, I guess, their LMAC, the SPAC, which, you know, it was surprising. I wouldn't say it was surprising. I mean, given that it's similar to how, you know, they invest and how they, you know, have executed, you know, deals over the last, you know, I guess, you know, multiple decades. But, you know, to the announcement that they're going to be, you know, kind of jumping into the SPAC wave was, you know, certainly interesting. It'll be, you know, curious. Obviously, I guess they're really won't talk about sort of the target or anything like that. Or, I mean, they won't be able to say much until, you know, something's announced. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that, particularly given that, you know, you've got the founder shares at F1. I don't think they can do anything really in motorsport because that would have to be something that would go to F1. I mean, they would have to kind of have first preference on that. Music, kind of the similar, where, you know, Sirius, I would assume, would have kind of first crack at that. And, you know, sports in general, you know, maybe that's an avenue. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they look at with that. I mean, they talked a lot about globality and about platforms and aggregators, and finding one of those that, you know, is kind of on the come is something that I think would be, you know, really interesting for them. But I mean, the problem is that if you're an aggregator, you're probably have your people probably know about you, and you're probably too big to buy. So that'll be interesting to see, you know, when that plays out. I guess they have 2 years to find a target for that.
Why do you think, so I agree, the Liberty SPAC was one of the things, you know, look, when you raise $500 million of dry powder, basically, and you're going to get basically a 20% incentive fee on it, that's always going to be a pretty interesting thing. But yeah. I guess that some of the things that jumped out at me at the SPAC, first, why do you think they assigned it to Formula One? Because, you know, Liberty Sirius, Formula One, and Atlanta Braves are all under the same roof. They could have assigned it to any of them. They could have done equal weight throughout the three. John Malone, actually, most of his money's in Liberty Sirius. So you'd think if he wanted most of the upside, he would either do this personally or he would have put it in Liberty Sirius. So why do you think they put it in Liberty Formula One?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I guess that there's with Liberty Series, I mean, they're clearly focused on chipping away at that discount. I mean, I think if you introduce the additional complexity at Liberty Series, I mean, that you're going to have a lot of a camp of shareholders that's probably pretty frustrated because you're trying to clean up the structure and compress this, I think it's a 35% discount to Series at this point. You introduce more complexity there with LMAC, and that's probably something that I would argue that it's not going to help close the discount. The Braves probably a little bit too, illiquid. I know that it's smaller. I think that a lot of what they talked about at the Investor Day was looking for a clean sort of value for the Braves, and they were talking about the Mets and the EV per win.
I could not believe they came out with EV per win. That's more of a knife twist than a real valuation metric.
Yeah, I think I glossed over that one, but if that's a priority for them, that's certainly not going to help getting a clean sort of value for the Braves and the Battery, and I think Formula One's the remainder. And I don't think there's been a huge sort of NAV disconnect at F1 relative to the intrinsic value.
The only thing that struck me with the Formula One spec, and I agree with everything you just said, Formula One basically had to get bailed out in March and April because of the pandemic. Sirius took their Live Nation stock, and they gave them a little upside. It probably ended up being a pretty good deal for Liberty Sirius. I didn't like it at the time, and I still don't love it for a variety of reasons, but it worked out well for Liberty Series.
Yeah.
And I almost wondered if the Formula One spat, if Formula One getting the founder share was a little tip to them, right? Like, hey, the capital structure was a little mismanaged. We had to bail you out. Here's an extra, the founder shares will be worth $200 million when the deal's done. Here's a little extra tip for you guys. Though at the same time, you're dealing with a Formula One that just had to get bailed out, and now you're tying up a little of their cash for the SPAC and the forward purchase and everything. It's just a little odd to me.
Yeah. It's a great question. And I there's a lot of liquidity at that tracker now. I think there's 2.6 billion or so.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of investors that I speak with and a lot of what I'm thinking about is how are they going to deploy, that capital? Because it seems like they've weathered the pandemic storm at this point, and 2021 should be a much more normal year for the operating business.
Yeah. And so you don't have, the other thing is, obviously everyone loves to play the parlor game of who are they going to buy? And the question is, like, at this point, there's 200 SPACs out there. There are private equity funds with tons of money. The tough thing with a SPAC is you don't have any operating synergy. So you really have to go buy something and be kind of the highest bidder. I was racking my brain trying to think of targets. It's tough. Nobody can ever really call one of these things, but there was nothing that kind of jumped out at you as, hey, this is an obvious Liberty SPAC target.
There's nothing on the private side that I look at that really jumps out at me. They had a slide in there they were talking about how maybe there's a disconnect between the medium-term value of some public and private companies, and obviously it would have to be private, versus kind of the short term, what the markets or what the valuations implying for those businesses, or maybe their the company's runway, if the pandemic kind of drags on. So, I think home furnishings was a category on that slide. So I don't think they're going to pursue anything in that category, but, it's interesting to sort of, a lot of these SPACs, the electric vehicle ones that are generating, no revenue, but are getting egregious valuations.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, and it seems like they will employ a disciplined approach, as they always do, to valuation. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
The two that I was just kind of tossing around in my mind, just completely randomly, was if Peloton wasn't public, I could see Peloton in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, Greg and the whole Liberty team love Peloton, but there's also a platform, a community. There's a bunch of different aspects that kind of touch on a lot of things that Liberty's played on. The other one that kind of struck me, and this might be more a Q-rate acquisition, but have you seen the S1 for Wish, that new S1?
Yeah, I have not gone through the S1, but I mean, I saw that they filed. Interesting.
For listeners, Wish is basically like they do Facebook ads and they say, hey, you can get a pair of headphones for $4, right? Which, you know, on Amazon, they'd go for $20. But you have to compromise because I think the quality might be a little compromised. It's not going to be next day shipping. You know, the shipping is going to be 30 days from now and all the sort of stuff. But it did strike me as, you know, it had some plays on Zulily and Qrate and stuff. I could see something like that. But yeah, there is nothing that super jumped out at me. Formula One, if they put it in the Liberty Braves, I could have seen them saying, hey, you know, there are a lot of sports owners who are attached to real estate and casinos who are hurting right now. I could have seen them getting more aggressive on, like, you know, Houston Rockets, Tillman Fertitta, he owns Golden Nugget casinos and stuff, getting aggressive there. But it doesn't seem like it's going to be an individual sports team. So yeah, kind of tough to say.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think that they were really, it seemed like Malone's, you know, the CNBC interview that he did and, you know, some of the things that came up in Q&A and in Greg's prepared remarks. I mean, they, you know, I think are keenly focused on platforms and on aggregators, and to find something that's maybe an early aggregator is interesting. I mean, you mentioned Peloton. That's something that I thought of as well. You know, a business like that, you know, I think is something that they seem like they're attracted to at this point.
Maybe like a Peloton competitor, like I think Lululemon owns Mirror, but you could see like the Mirror, which is a mirror that you just, I understand, you connect to, like maybe one of those subscription services. What about, you mentioned the aggregators. And another thing that jumped out to me was Malone, between a CNBC interview where I think it was a CNBC interview where he said, I'm selling assets to buy commercial real estate and hard assets.
Yeah.
And then Greg, you know, I was shocked by the first thing Greg's comments were was Zoom is going to benefit hugely from this pandemic. Don't look at it as a tech company, or don't look at it as just like Video Connect. We're doing Zoom right now. It's going to become an aggregator, and I'm super bullish Zoom. Malone said he'd buy Facebook and Amazon stock right now. You know, it almost seems to me like they wanted to own the assets that they don't currently own, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Were you reading into that, or did you kind of get that sense?
I mean, it's certainly, you know, the way that they were, the way that they were talking about, you know, some of these businesses. I mean, if you think about, you know, another Liberty type company, you know, IAC, I mean, it seemed like some of those, you know, businesses.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but yeah, I think that, you know, that they seem like they, you know, with the companies that they, I mean, they seem like they're in a, you know, they like Live Nation still. I mean, they seem pretty bullish on, you know, a lot of the businesses and, you know, they've done a lot over the past year to make sure that they're well capitalized. And I think that there's going to be a lot of, you know, longer term tailwinds for a lot of these companies in the portfolio from the pandemic.
What about, speaking of the pandemic? So another thing that jumped out to me, there was a line where they said, hey, when the pandemic hit, we separated into two teams, a red team that would go raise liquidity. And I think most people would agree the red team did a fantastic job. You know, every Formula One was facing some issues. They got Formula One settled. All of their companies have raised exchangeables at really interesting rates. Like none of their, if the country shut down for another year, I don't think any of their companies would have liquidity issues at this point. So I think that red team got to work. They did a lot of stuff and they did a great job. They also said we separated into a green team, and the green team was focused on taking advantage of the pandemic and opportunities. And I think a lot of people were surprised by how kind of quickly the pandemic was forgotten. You know, you basically, if you didn't buy something in early March, in late March or early April, you kind of missed it. But I couldn't really, I'm wondering if the green team was out for nap, because I couldn't really think of anything the green team did. Can you think of any, like, you know, Liberty strikes and takes advantage of the pandemic opportunities?
Yeah. I think you gotta tip your hat to the red team, like you said, but, I think it's exactly that. I mean, things recovered much more quickly than I think there was probably any time to really go out and take advantage of some of these dislocations. You know, at the same time, and you had the backstop of the Fed, and yet the credit markets were reopened pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And, I think that that's just it. I mean, there probably just was not enough time to really get out and, you know, take advantage. I mean, if you know, this had gone, you know, a couple more quarters, then absolutely. I mean, I think that they probably had, you know, with the liquidity that they had at some of these companies, you know, and they're probably still, there are opportunities out there, but at a valuation that was attractive to them. And I think that this would have had to drag on for a little bit longer than it did for, you know, to give the green team proper kudos, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. No, it's just, you know, Liberty Sirius buying Live Nation from Formula One. You know, my issue with the deal wasn't that it was a good deal for Liberty Sirius. I thought it would probably work out well for them. But my issue was more, if I wanted Live Nation, I could go buy Live Nation stock. You know, the best deal you could do in like this pandemic was go buy Live Nation stock from Formula One and kind of reattribute. You know, I've just been disappointed by the lack of, you know, SiriusXM was depths of the financial crisis. They bought for what, like 10 cents a share, and now the thing's $6 and they pay 5 cents per year in dividends.
Right.
Speaking of SiriusXM, obviously you cover it. I think the team's been great. You know, last year's Investor Day started with the power of the ear, right? I think they've known all along podcasting was going to be big. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they've executed as much. SiriusXM, it's a little bit of a battleground stock, right? It trades at 20 plus times EBITDA. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say satellite radio is going away. You know, you take your iPhone, you plug it into your car, you can listen to Spotify on there. But that's been the bear case for years. You've got a buy case on Sirius.
Yeah.
What do you see in Sirius? Like, why are you so comfortable with the terminal value, and how do you see this evolving over the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think that it's a great question, and Sirius, you know, I think it was hard to argue that in the depths of April. I mean, just like many things, I mean, Sirius, I think, was, you know, touching a four handle, and you know, the business, it became clear pretty quickly that the business was not going to be impacted as much as the market, I think, initially thought.
You say that, but SiriusXM is one of those ones where I was actually nervous, right? Because nobody's doing their commute into work anymore. And I was like, if you've got SiriusXM, a big use case is probably I drive 30 minutes in the morning, 30 minutes at night, I listen to SiriusXM, cancel that because I'm not going to be driving to work for 18 months. A lot of news, you know, I thought the economy would be worse for a while, so not a lot of used new car sales and stuff. But I was really worried about a lot more churn than they started, and the business is just humming. But please go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great point, and I agree with you. I mean, the fact that there was not a material uptick in churn was pretty astonishing. And you know, Sirius has they have a couple of drivers of churn, and you know, one of them is the involuntary churn where you're going and you're buying a new car and you are counted as a in the churn figure.
Yep.
And that obviously got a benefit, but at the same time, involuntary churn was, you know, up a little bit, but not much. And non-pay, the third bucket, you know, just bounced back. Card payments was actually, you
know, oops. I think we lost Zach for a second here, having some internet issues. We will see if we can get him reconnected. Oh man, Zach doesn't come back in the next 10 seconds or so, we're going to have a quite an editing
flat, or I think they said maybe improved, and part of that was due to been tweaking over the years and improving. But I think it speaks to the resilience of the of.
Hey Zach, can you hear me? We lost you for about 20, 30 seconds there.
Yeah, let's. Andrew, can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Can you see me?
Yep.
Okay. It said, it was a unstable connection.
No worries.
So what I was saying, I don't know what I cut out, but I think that the fact that churn has stayed, you know, at pre-pandemic levels, despite Sirius being a largely discretionary, not largely, but 100% discretionary expense, and one that's, you know, probably not as important as your, clearly not as important as things like home broadband and other, communications and entertainment expenses that you may have. I think just speaks to the value of the service, and, you know, people coming in and, you know, getting back on the road is probably going to help that metric. I mean, I think that the fact is that you've got, I think, 110 or so million cars on the road with Sirius now. Over the next 5 years, there will be, I think, double that number, 200 million cars on the road that have Sirius installed. by the way, it's going to also be 80% of those cars in 5 years, new cars are going to have this 360L, which is going to be a better experience for them. It's going to allow them benefits on the sales and marketing side. It's going to allow them, you know, more personalized offerings. And I mean, I think if you just run a, you look at even, you know, serious stable sort of operating cash flow and, you know, very sort of asset light business besides the satellite launches that they have. And you look at what they've done on the, you know, on the share repurchase side and very generous returns of capital to shareholders. I mean, it's not difficult to get to a stock that's, you know, meaningfully higher than where we are today. And
Not to lead the witness here, but one of the interesting things with SiriusXM that I've always talked about is, you know, it is not lost on Greg and team, as we talked about, the power of audio, right? They led with that last year. That was the highlight of their Investor Day presentation. And SiriusXM has a lot of podcasting capabilities, I would say, right? They're not doing it right now, but they've got all of Howard Stern stuff. You know, they've got those DJs who come out every day and film a lot of stuff. But I've been a little disappointed. You know, they haven't really... They bought Stitcher, they've got Pandora, but I don't think they've really moved a lot into original podcasting. And, you know, it's not lost on the team how valuable original podcasting is. I remember an interview with Greg over the summer where Spotify signed up Joe Rogan and their stock went up by 15%. And then they signed up the Kardashians and their stock went up 25%. And he was saying these moves are crazy. So it's not lost on them that the market values this and that they've got a lot of assets, but they haven't really moved in there. How have you thought about the podcasting opportunity for Sirius? And like, do you see kind of hidden value in there, or am I kind of just missing it?
I think that by and large, I mean, the podcasting opportunity for Sirius, I mean, given that so much of their content is unique spoken word content to begin with, is largely just a continuation of what they've been doing. I think that it seems like the way that they're going to approach it is have sort of marquee, higher value originals behind the Sirius paywall and really have more of a full ecosystem of, you know, third-party podcasts and all the Stitcher, podcasts on Pandora. And they also talked a little bit at the Investor Day, I think for the first time, about this ad supported Sirius model, which could be interesting outside of the car to have, you know, Sirius, you know, either a lower cost Sirius or just fully ad supported Sirius. It isn't clear, you know, how they're going to divvy up the assets between Sirius and Pandora, which I think is what a lot of investors have struggled with the Pandora acquisition since they did it. You know, it's been a couple of years at this point, and I think that's still kind of to be seen how they wind up kind of cross marketing and splitting content between those two services. But I do think that there's, you know, when you look at the moves Spotify's had by executing these original deals, you know, that the same value is there for Sirius. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a subscription offering with a higher ARPU and better economics than, at least right now, than Spotify. And I think that you will see them push more into these exclusive originals. I think that they're probably a little bit more rational on the price side than Spotify. Well, I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's in the eyes of the buyer. But I would like to see them get more aggressive with the originals, and they certainly have the capital to do that.
Yeah. It's just interesting because obviously it's a different business model, and you know, Liberty, their famous quote the past couple of years is business models matter, which I don't think anybody disagrees, but you know, Spotify's over there they're buying a bunch of podcasts to try to build out like basically the podcast platform, right? Where they're going to dynamically insert ads and they've got all this user info. And it seems like Sirius has assets, but I just don't know how they ever replicate that. So I almost wonder if they're drawing dead. And I agree with you. There's a lot of value. They have a lot of credit card info. Obviously, the business is great, but those terminal value questions, you know, they weigh in my mind and a lot of investor mind. And that's the opportunity, right? Like if people valued Sirius like there were no terminal value, the thing would be a lot higher. Anyway, last thoughts on Liberty Day, Sirius? Anything you want to talk about before we turn to Curiosity Stream?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing to note about Sirius during the Investor Day, I mean, one of the things they talked about, and one thing that I do think is underappreciated about the business, is just the off-platform opportunity that they have with Stitcher. AdsWiz is just a hidden gem in Pandora. I mean, I would argue that that's one of the more valuable things that came out of that Pandora acquisition was the programmatic audio platform in AdsWizz. And I think that with that combination of assets and now Stitcher, where they have a very large digital audio sales force, a kind of podcast native sales force, and they've spent a lot of capital investing in ad tech on the audio side.
Yeah,
I mean, you just saw one of their announcements recently was NBC News, that they renewed their deal with them. But in that deal, I think something that's underappreciated, and this isn't obviously a needle mover for the company, but they're going to be handling all of NBC News, CNBC, all of that digital audio, all of their podcasts, all of their off-platform business. And I think that you'll see them get more off-platform business. And that is, it's a great, kind of high margin business for them with AdsWizz and with Stitcher leveraging some of that.
Well, look, you know the IR team over there. If you want to tell them, yet another value podcast, we're very open to being Liberty Spawn. I love the Liberty
team. I'll link you up. Yeah, they'll send you some swag, I guess, for some merch.
Last question on Sirius. We're taping this right before Thanksgiving 2020. If we tape another pod, after Liberty Day 2021, is Liberty, have they crossed the 80% ownership threshold of Sirius?
Based on the model that I've got here.
We've got him pulling up Excel now. I can see the glow on his face.
Yeah, geez. That's a sad state of affairs. It looks like they actually do cross into right over 80% in the fourth quarter of 21.
Okay, perfect. Hopefully they do that. So for listeners who don't follow, Liberty owns about 75% of Sirius at this point. Once they cross 80%, all the dividends from Sirius go tax-free up to Liberty. So everyone's always thought Liberty really wants to get there, because those of you who know Liberty know they do not like paying the tax man. So that would be nice. And that probably unlocks some capital allocation choices for Sirius, like kind of increasing their dividend stuff. Okay, so let's turn over to your most recent coverage. This is the company we kind of want to focus on today, CuriosityStream. I think you're the only analyst who covers them. I listened to their earnings call last week, and you were certainly the only analyst who asked the question. So do you want to give a little bit of background on the company, how it came public, why you're following it, why you like it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the company, there was a SPAC called Software Acquisition Group, which was, I think the sponsor was a guy who ran a couple of video streaming businesses, and the target that they found was CuriosityStream, which is the real focus. And that is a business that I think was started kind of at the middle of the decade, 2015 or so, but had been incubating for, I think, much longer. And I say that because John Hendricks, who was the founder of Discovery, founded out of his garage and launched, first launched in 1985. He stepped down in 2015. Basically, his thought was that Discovery is kind of beholden to a industry structure and a pay TV bundle that's in secular decline. I think that I'm better off starting a new business that's unencumbered from these legacy pressures. And I think that, I'm gonna bootstrap a lot of this. I'm gonna raise some outside capital. I think that the TAM's large enough where we can go out. I have my Rolodex. I've got, calling cards in with all the production houses and with all of the distributors around the world. And, let's give it a go and see if we can make this work. And that is really where we're at today. I mean, I think that they're, obviously a very small company. I think they're going to do about $40 million of revenue this year, which but growing at a very healthy clip. Their strategy is basically a Discovery that's built for the over-the-top streaming world, where they're basically selling SVOD direct-to-consumer subscriptions. They are bundling with distributors across the world, and they've got some other they're doing the traditional sort of content program sales. And it's an interesting business, because if they are successful in establishing a lot of direct to consumer relationships, if they sort of become the de facto kind of streaming age service for factual, I think that there's massive value creation there. And if they are, and the other point is just that the content cost that they is very low on this actual side. I mean, I think they've said that it's their kind of an hour of CuriosityStream content is 100,000 or so, whereas an episode of Game of Thrones is 10 million. So they've got, you know, they don't need, they can price at pretty attractive levels, a pretty compelling value prop for the consumer, you know, high gross margins if they are able to get scale. And it's, you know, an interesting, I think it's the only other kind of pure play video streamer besides Netflix. It's public. So it's been an interesting one to follow.
I think there's also Gaia, though. I do. That is a completely different type of video streaming.
That's true.
I've looked at this company a pretty good bit, and you know, I agree with you. It's interesting, but I haven't been able to kind of, as they say, get there yet. Right? I think the SKU's wide, and the two. I'm going to go through the two big questions I have here. Right. The first big question is, hey, you know, they're going to do a streaming service of what I think of as kind of Nat Geo or Discovery, right? They're going to give you the streaming service. I think they're going to price it at $3 per month is where they're pricing it. They're still working on it, but it's obviously going to be cheaper. So what they're really looking for is, hey, you have Netflix, you want more natural Geo Discovery type content, pay us $3 a month and we're going to get this all to you, right? Mm-hmm. And my first question is like, look, if I have Netflix, I already get Planet Earth or whatever they're calling it and a bunch of things on Netflix. Mm-hmm. How big is the market for people who want this content so much that they're going to go out and pay an additional fee to get this type of stuff?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's what I was thinking about this company and whether I thought that this, you know, 5 years from now, is this a successful business or not? I mean, that is, I think the key question is there enough demand for this factual content where you can sort of make it a standalone service? And I think that based on looking at some of the ratings that Discovery gets on its linear channels or had gotten across the world, based on survey work that we've done in the States around Discovery's, you know, upcoming a la carte offering, which we can get to, but I think is something a lot different than what CuriosityStream is doing. I think that it's become clear that, I mean, this is a bigger category than I thought it was. Mm-hmm. when I initially looked at this and it's like, this is kind of a niche, you know, who's going to pay for this. But really for, it's $20 a year for their annual plan, which is what they're, I think, getting 80% of the new connects on. And I think that there is probably some value in, you know, a brand safe service that is just focused on documentary on factual. You look at Netflix and yeah, they do have a lot of documentaries, but it pales in comparison to what Curi has, just in terms of the categories that they touch.
Yeah.
Netflix, I mean, I think is mostly nature and they have a lot of science stuff on there as well. But yeah, Hendrix frames it. He says that it's a much broader genre than people give it credit for. And I think it's to be determined. What I do know is, and you know, I'm still, you know, I think the jury's still out there. What I do know is that the value that the market ascribes to these businesses that are able to establish a global brand and have a direct relationship with the consumer, and oh, by the way, at you know, very attractive economics from a content cost perspective. There's an opportunity for what I think is asymmetric risk reward, where, you know, if they fail, you've got, you know, 900 owned shows and you've got, you know, Netflix maybe saying, hey, this is not a bad business to add to our factual content library at, you know, what would probably be, something comparable to what we can make this content for on our own. So I think there is a little bit of a floor there. But the upside is just, it's pretty remarkable if they're able to succeed.
Look, I agree. The upside is pretty big, right? If you can get a lot of people on this, you look at what these things trade for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the ways I've looked at this is like, you know, Disney Plus. If I get Disney Plus, the way they market it is five channels, right? Like you have Disney Plus and you've got the Marvel channel, you've got the Star Wars channel, you've got the Nat Geo channel, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I've almost thought about with Curi and Discovery, who I want to talk to Discovery in a second as well, but I've almost wonder if they've got more as an acquisition target where they fill in that channel, right? So Disney Plus already has Nat Geo, but maybe HBO Max, you know, I don't think they've got a lot of documentary service and stuff. Maybe like HBO Max needs that Curie channel. But the weird thing with that is if you're almost an acquisition target, and the reason I bring this up is you said Netflix might buy them for the library. If you're an acquisition target, they probably don't really care about how many subs and all the tech and stuff you've built out, right? Like they just want to grab your content, throw it onto their service and put it into their library. So do you see any divergence there? Does that make sense?
Totally agree. And I think that it's interesting you bring up HBO Max because they actually, in the second quarter, I mean, they did, you know, a output deal with HBO Max, or a sub-licensing deal for, you know, $4 million or so dollars, which is pennies for HBO Max, but huge for somebody with a base.
Very meaningful, that, yep.
Right. And I mean, it totally makes sense. And, you know, getting back to, you know, when we first started our conversation, this around aggregators and around, you know, having global scale, you know, HBO Max is certainly doesn't, you know, more domestic, but I think that, you know, for Curie to work, I mean, they're going to have to find a way to get scale. And that's really going through at this point, you know, they're going to invest in the direct-to-consumer, you know, marketing and in original content that's going to help drive word of mouth. But what they're really leveraging right now is a lot of relationships with distributors that have, you know, a large sub base that they can reach for a pretty low cost. And I think if they can get enough of that, then at some point they'll be able to transition to more of a DTC model. But it's not out of the question that, I mean, this certainly fits in well with a lot of the larger streaming companies out there that, you know, I think in our initiation report, I mean, Netflix, I think, has a couple hundred factual titles and, you know, 500 or 600, and Curie has 3,000. And in the SPAC, you know, in the merger projections, they're talking about getting to like 10,000 titles over the next 5 years.
One of the things with streaming services, and we're going to come back to distribution when we talk discovery, but one of the things with streaming services that I think we've all seen in all of them, we'll even say, look, buzzy originals are for customer acquisitions, you know, you know, the Martin Scorsese movie on Netflix, or the, you know, Stranger Things, that's how you acquire your customers. And then your library is for your customer retention. So your offices and Parks and Rec, that's really about giving them a lot of hours to watch to hold on to the customers. When I think about, you know, Curiosity Stream or Discovery Sump, I wonder if their content is more suited towards customer retention than customer acquisition. And I wonder if Curiosity Stream has an issue where, yeah, they build out 10,000 titles that are great for customer retention, but they have trouble actually grabbing that customer because they don't have that one title that really grabs you. You know, like Planet Earth would probably be the buzziest natural show out there, or I guess maybe Tiger King, if you wanted to call that a kind of natural show. But I don't know if Curiosity can really get enough of those things that really grab consumers. Does that make sense? Is that a worry that you have at all?
It's I mean, it's definitely something that that I've thought about it, and they really are going to need, you know, new Planet Earth. I mean, they're going to need, I think, in their, you know, in the roadshow, they talked about doing, you know, six kind of marquee shows that have, you know, bigger talent, or they are more expensive to make. And I think what you need is you do need some hits that are going to be buzzed about and be reported about. Obviously, in the factual category, it's, I think, a little bit more difficult to do that than it is, you know, to have you know, Queen's Gambit that, you know, a lot of people are talking about, or, you know, something where it kind of, the story itself kind of grabs you, and it's kind of water cooler, I guess, used to be water cooler talk. But I think for them, I mean, you know, get a couple of buzzy originals, you know, get some big name narrators in there. And, but it's really going to come down to, I think, the marketing approach. And they've had a lot of success with direct response marketing through, you know, Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. And they're doing a lot of innovative things on the marketing side, where they're actually paying, like, let's say it's a YouTube influencer, you know, if you will, they will actually go out and pay one of these influencers who reaches, you know, a couple million people anyway, to sort of do a co-brand with CuriosityStream. And that's I think that's nimbleness that they have as a smaller company that, you know, maybe the bigger guys are not thinking about.
That's really interesting, because that's one of the things that I've always thought is under tap, like companies using these YouTube streamers or anyone who, I mean, these things get millions of views and the people who follow them are super passionate. Like, mm-hmm. I've always wondered why, if you're and actually some gaming companies have started doing this, but if you're a gaming company and you're launching a game, why not pay Ninja $100,000 to stream your game four times or 5 hours or something, you know? Or, right. You know, like I love Binge Mode, which is a podcast that dives deep into different, like, really nerdy things like Game of Thrones and stuff. Like, if you're mm-hmm. launching a Game of Thrones competitor, why not go pay Binge Mode $100,000 to review your things and push it out to your fans so that the fans of that show might want to go do it? But yeah, I do worry, just going back to, like, you know, with Q3 earnings, CuriosityStream came out with this Beyond the Spotlight, which I'm looking at, which, you know, it tells one of Kristen Bell's stories and Shaq's stories and Samuel L. Jackson's stories, which I love all of those guys, but I just don't feel like those are really buzzy enough to, like, grab people, but it's interesting they're doing.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know. I think you can look to things like Planet Earth, and I'm sure that they have things that they're working on that they are hopeful that will become, you know, very buzzworthy shows, but it's harder to do in the factual side. I think you're right there. You know, the benefit is that, you know, they do have a large library. And if you believe that sort of dynamic about new shows or customer acquisition and churn is driven by the library volume, then, you know, they're probably pretty well suited for that.
So the other pushback, I think, with Curious, you know, Curie published a slide when they merged, and they said, hey, we're merging at, if you buy us, you're buying us for 2.5 times forward revenues if you buy us, right? Mm-hmm. And Spotify and Netflix are the two that they pointed to, I think, where they said, hey, these guys trade at 10 times forward revenues. If we hit on this, we're going to trade at 10 times forward revenue. And I think the pushback would be, yeah, but Discovery trades at 2 times forward revenues, right? And Discovery, you know, they're getting ready to launch. They're going to do their big DTC announcement at the beginning of December. And I think a lot of people might say, hey, you're kind of building this up, but all Discovery has to do is launch, and they've already got the catalog. They've already got all this sort of stuff. And they're out there trading at 2 times revenue, you know, like 8 times EBITDA. And they're going to launch, and as soon as they get the tech right, they've got 10 times the amount of catalog you do. Plus, they do have these buzzy shows, right? And it's also going to be co-branded with, it's not just Discovery, it's going to be Discovery plus Food Network plus all these other shows. So why would I pay $20 per month for you when I could go pay maybe $20 per year for you when I could pay $50 for Discovery and get all that other stuff? Does that make sense? Just the opportunity cost and kind of getting eaten alive by this bigger player.
Yeah, I think that we'll be closely watching what Discovery says. I think it's December 2nd is their you know, sort of the debut and the investor day where they're going to unveil the DTC strategy. What my sense around that strategy right now is that it's going to be more like what Fox News has done with Fox Nation, where it's going to be a platform for kind of super fans of the personalities on Fox News or on Discovery. So you think about some of the HGTV, I don't know their names, but whoever they are, that you know, America
Chip and
loves.
Joanna. I think Chip and Joanna.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the one. So they'll have a Chip and Joanna, you know, channel on the DTC app, or, you know, library of special programming there for them. And that's sort of what I've heard. I think that it's difficult for Discovery to take all of their content that is still encumbered by, I mean, the distributors are paying them, you know, billions of dollars for in affiliate fees. And there's going to have to be, you know, either a point of reckoning where the distributors say, okay, we're not going to pay you. We'd love for you to go over the top and use, you know, more of our internet services or broadband services, or they say, you know, you need to stay with us because we're paying you all this money. You can't have it both ways. And I think that's going to be a tricky thing for Discovery to kind of navigate, and which leads me to believe that the offering is probably going to be tailored more around sort of the the reality type personalities that they have, kind of for the super fan of Discovery. I don't know. And yes, I mean, if they're truly going and pursuing the exact same thing that Curie is doing, I mean, that's a problem. And that's a problem. And it's something that's worth paying attention to.
Is that one of the reasons you're bullish on Curie? So like, look, if I told you tomorrow Discovery is going to put out an announcement that says, hey, none of our channels will be available on cable subscriptions anymore. You can get all of our channels for $5 per month in this direct to consumer app. That would probably break your Curiosity Stream thesis, right? But your thesis is almost, hey, they're so wedded and they're making billions of dollars a year from the cable channel bundle. So there's nothing, but your thesis almost, hey, they're so wedded to that they can't put it. So Curiosity Stream comes in, they offer hundreds of hours of original programming and they say, hey, you love Discovery. You're cutting the cord. You can't get that anymore. Come get something similar from us right here for $2 per month. Am I kind of expressing your thesis maybe a little more cynically, but does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that for Curiosity to really work, it would have to be something where Discovery would have a very difficult time kind of transitioning off of the legacy model. Then again, I mean, Curiosity, it's sort of built more nimble than Discovery is to begin with, and it doesn't have these linear whether it be declining TV subs, whether it be a very high cost structure, whether it be more expensive reality type programming. Even if that does happen, I still think that Curiosity can undercut Discovery on price and make the economics actually work better than Discovery. So I don't think that Discovery making that, I mean, sure, it would not be great for the stock would get whacked, I think, in the short term, but I don't think it would be the death knell for Curie. I mean, it's an important part of the thesis, but it's not the key driver of it.
Hey, for years, Netflix was the Albanian army to HBO, right? And they were that until all of a sudden they were multiples bigger than HBO. You know, I think we've spent the past few minutes, we've spent more time talking about Discovery than Netflix. And I think that's because, you think Curiosity's content and you think Discovery. Are you more worried about Discovery or the Discovery piece of it, where Discovery wants to get into what Curiosity's doing? Are you more worried about the first thing we talked about where, hey, I subscribe to Netflix, I can get Planet Earth and four other factual shows. I don't need more. Why subscribe to Curiosity? Which one of those two kind of worries you more?
Well, I think that you do have to worry more about Discovery. And that's really a function of Netflix is focused on these big scripted splashy shows. And they have to be focused on that because that's how they justify the, $12 to $15 a month that people are paying for Netflix. And that's also how they're going to justify continued ARPU growth for the business. I think that it would be strange as a happy Netflix subscriber myself if all that I saw was factual programming. And I still think that for Curie, there's some sort of brand is not necessarily a competitive advantage, but you can be differentiated and be a compelling enough value. If you market it right, you can get some consumer adoption. And I think that what they're doing on the distribution side, where they're getting into, they're leveraging relationships with distributors to, at a lower ARPU, but they're able to get distribution, I think is important for them. So I would say that it's really more on the Discovery side, I think is a bigger threat because that's sort of apples to apples competition. For Netflix, I mean, I think they're always going to be associated with, you could put a lot of factual on Netflix and you may still subscribe to Curie, or you may have a differentiated enough product to still be valuable to consumers.
If this thesis works out, when would you know the thesis is working out, right? Because it takes time to build the scale and get this flywheel. Is it 2 years from now where you can really start saying, hey, they've got acceleration in subs? Is it 4 years from now? When does the thesis really kind of start to prove itself out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it all starts with looking at, the actual unit economics of the DTC business on Curie. And what they have right now is, I think, monthly churn that's around 2%. Again, the ARPU at $20 a month and or $20 a year and $3 a month is nothing, you know, mind blowing. I think it's $2.50 or so. And if they're able to keep driving churn down, they've talked about, potentially, I guess if they're able to keep really driving churn down and they are generating, they're able to invest enough in the marketing side of things. And I was fishing for that word, but around subscriber acquisition cost. I mean, that's another big part of it. I mean, they're saying that that SAC is, sub $50 per sub. And I think that over time, if you see them through some of these large distribution relationships and through some of the marketing that they're doing, if they're able to actually increase awareness of the service, increase engagement, so you've got churn and SAC moving in the right directions, I'm comfortable that the business can continue to grow. I think that they will, if they need more capital for marketing or content, I think they'll be able to go out and get that.
Yep.
And that's really what I'm looking for is just that the unit economics of the DTC business continue to improve and that they're able to get some of these lower ARPU distribution deals done that they've talked about. And that's, if things fall apart there, which I think, you brought up Gaia earlier, and that I think is what has, been really challenging for them, is that it's just too small of a market and it costs them an arm and a leg to acquire new customers, and their churn, I think has been it's theoretically the these older cohorts the churn should be going down, but it's not.
Gaia is an interesting comp because a lot of the stuff, it's alternative truth, which I'll leave it to the listeners for what they think.
It's a nightly view for you.
What's that?
Is it a nightly view for you?
No, but a lot of this stuff is literally like, hey, dinosaurs are the ones who built the pyramid 6,000 years and stuff. I say literally, it might not be exactly that, but it's very close to that. And yeah. if this year's taught me anything, is that there's a bigger market for that than I thought. But Gaia has still had kind of trouble getting the flow going. Last question from Curie. Curie, starts hitting their metrics and starts hitting the flywheel. It's proving out. If we come back 3 to 5 years and revisit Curie and the thesis has worked properly, do you think it's just they're standalone? They've probably issued some equity to keep that flywheel growing, buy some more content, but they're just growing as a standalone. Do you think they're standalone? They've issued some equity, but they've bought some other verticals, right? Like maybe they've gone out and bought, I don't want to say Gaia because they're probably not getting into alternative truth, but maybe they've gone out and bought like a Nat Geo or something else. Or do you think, hey, this is starting to be proven out. It's working. And we talked about, I think this is a channel under another umbrella. HBO Max has come and bought them, and they have the Curie channel, similar to how Disney Plus has the Nat Geo channel. Which one of those three do you think is most likely if this is kind of working out and proving out?
Yeah, I think that probably the second one, and that they they're hitting their metrics, the engagement is good, and they're able to actually generate consumer awareness and build a brand for the service. They're getting distribution, global distribution through these providers, but there's going to be some inflection. But if this does work, there's going to be some point where you'll start to hear them talk about, okay, we have built a big enough brand at this point, and enough of an identity, and enough consumer awareness that we can really start to try and focus on these distribution deals that they're doing with, cable and wireless broadband providers across the world are very different from the linear deals that you're familiar with the cable TV networks. So they would be able to wean off of those deals much more easily. I could see them, at that point they would have more capital to invest in marketing for the DTC service. And I think along the way, there probably are a couple of whether it's libraries, or whether it's kind of other, much smaller kind of niche. They're pretty small at this point, so I don't know how you get much smaller, but probably on the library side or maybe vertical integration on the production content side, where they would do some deals.
Perfect. Anything else we should be talking about, Curie, or are you ready to wrap it up there?
I think, you know, it's early. I think that all the pushback that you brought up, I mean, it's totally fair. I think that it's just got a very interesting sort of risk reward skew, you know, if they are able to go out and succeed. And, I think they're a quarter in as a public company. So we'll see how it goes.
No, I agree with you. I'm not there yet, but over time, as I get more, as I evolve as an investor, like, I want to look more for opportunities that have right-hand skew and spend more time on the companies that have like that right-hand return. If this is right, it's a 5X or 3X or something. And Curie definitely fits in there. You know, as you said, they're backed by Discovery's founder. They've got a lot of industry contact. So it's really interesting. I'm excited to follow them. I'm excited to continue to talk to you while we follow them. So I think we'll wrap it up there. Zach, thanks for joining us. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks to all our listeners. And if anybody wants to reach out to Zach, you know, you can talk to B. Riley, or I can put you in touch if you reach out to me. But Zach, this has been great. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Talk to you soon, man. Bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.